So it is my true honor on several fronts to introduce our speaker, Annie Mars, today. She is both an exceptional colleague in the field of Alzheimer's work and a friend, and she thoroughly understands the shoes that each and every one of you are in or afraid you may be in when it comes to Alzheimer's and dementia. And I can say that with great confidence. Annie Mars is the Family Services Director for the Central and Western Virginia chapter of the Alzheimer's Association for 12 years now. She is a licensed clinical social worker with her university work being done at James Madison University and Radford University. Now, what does a family services director do? And I think it's helpful for you to know that as you hear her presentation. She works at facilitating support groups for caregivers and individuals dealing with dementia and Alzheimer's. She does a lot of community presentations and training. So not only presentations like this one, but trainings for individuals like first responders on how to handle dementia and Alzheimer's. She provides individual and family care consultations, and I like to call that helping you find that roadmap, which is going to be a long, windy roadmap in dealing with Alzheimer's and dementia, so you can help navigate that disease. She also works with supporting and training volunteers. So if anyone has time and a particular interest in being involved in providing programs and services through the Alzheimer's Association, Annie Mars can help you with that. The Alzheimer's Association always welcomes your gifts and talents of time. Annie lives in Louisa, as she likes to say, the big city of Louisa in Louisa County, with her husband and two young children. She enjoys a great cup of coffee, taking photographs, and hiking through our state and national parks. So it is my true pleasure to welcome Annie Mars to the podium.
Thank you, and thank you to all of you for taking your time today. I hope to shed some further light and details on Alzheimer's and related dementias, as well as the warning signs if you or someone you know might be concerned about normal aging or when to possibly be proactive in speaking with your doctors about any cognitive impairment concerns. There will be time for questions as well, and so I welcome questions and conversation after the program. So I'm going to do my first click of technology here and knowing that it's going to work. So throughout the program, there's going to be just a few videos. One of the nice things, as Sue mentioned, some of my experience, but also that there are experts in the field of research, which is not my expertise, as well as individuals with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's and related dementia. And individuals will be able to speak to us for some brief times throughout this program. So we're actually going to start by hearing a little bit about the impact of Alzheimer's disease from Mr. Peterson.
In general, we talk about in individuals age 65 and older that people have perhaps an 8 to 10% risk of developing Alzheimer's disease over their lifetime. But it's clearly age-related. So if your family tends to live into their 80s and maybe 90s, your risk is going to go up rather dramatically. On the other hand, if people in your family tend to die in their 70s, the risk is lower. But it's clearly an age-related phenomenon, and with baby boomers, now those individuals born between the years of 1946 and 1964, moving into their 60s, this is going to exaggerate the number of people eligible, so to speak, for Alzheimer's disease rather dramatically. Some people have indicated that if we do not do something for Alzheimer's disease, meaning delay the onset, slow the progression, ideally we'd like to cure the disease, but even if we have these modulating effects on Alzheimer's disease, it as a single entity will bankrupt the healthcare system as we know it, because there are so many people in that age who will need services, will need extra care, that this will bankrupt the system.
Wow. I always feel like after hearing that, wow is about the only thing that comes to mind. And there is some more details on the facts and figures of Alzheimer's disease in the back. We will be talking today about the risks and how we might be able to lower our risks, because as Dr. Peterson said, right now we do not have a prevention. We do not have treatment, which we will also speak about today, and we do not have a cure for this disease. And to his point, we know that age being the greatest risk factor is something we cannot control, and this disease is impacting more and more of us personally and our communities. So I do want to talk just a couple minutes about typical age-related changes. And that way, I want to just contrast a couple minutes about what does it mean then if we are concerned about our own cognition or someone that we may know as a family or friend. So I also make it a point to not read the slides. I did print the slides for everyone today, and so you can pick those up on your way out. So please just be aware of that. So just to look at typical age-related changes hopefully makes many of us in the room feel much better about what is going on with us on a day-to-day basis. And yes, we are allowed to forget where we have left an item. We are allowed to call someone by the wrong name and not have Alzheimer's disease and not have that be a concern. But respectfully, many of us are impacted in this room, and that is also where if we know somebody with the disease, especially if there's someone in our family, it's very easy to jump to that conclusion and say, oh my goodness, I have misplaced my umbrella, or I didn't put my car keys where they should be, and so therefore I have Alzheimer's disease or a related dementia issue. And so I do always like to point out that we are allowed flexibility and to not jump into the conclusion that, oh my goodness, this is happening to me. I think we know that the disease is not contagious, but I often work with care partners, and care partners a lot of times in level of stress and multitasking will say, oh my goodness, I think I am getting what my husband or my father or my brother has in this disease, because multitasking and having too much going on in your brain can look a little bit like you are experiencing cognitive decline that is not normal. And so we're going to talk just a minute about that. We are going to hear from Joyce, and that will also help to put together for you what is not common aging and how Joyce became concerned about her memory.
A time when I was dialing the phone and I couldn't dial the phone. And so I went to the neurologist, and I did some tests, and they said it didn't seem that anything was different. But then a couple of months later, I noticed that not only could I not dial a phone, but I was having difficulties writing. I was having difficulty spelling simple words like of and the. I was falling a lot. I began to have accidents, like minor accidents, driving accidents. And at that time, my husband said, you know, we're going to the doctor.
And Joyce didn't share how old she is, and we never guess people's ages by how we look. But to talk again about Dr. Peterson and age being that greatest risk factor is that individuals under the age of 65 are impacted by Alzheimer's and related diseases. Right now, the Charlottesville office of Central and Western Virginia's Alzheimer's Association has a younger onset support group going on, and there are 5 gentlemen under the age of 60 impacted with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or another kind of progressive dementia. And so, we may look at age as being the greatest risk factor, and it is. However, it does not discount that individuals in their 40s and 50s are also developing this disease. I'm not going to walk through all 10 of these memory changes, but I am going to speak for a couple minutes about a couple choices here. And one, I think just to go back to Joyce's experience, not being able to write a word such as of or the, not being able to dial a phone. These are pretty big life impacting changes, not just that a new cell phone or a new way of logging in, a change to what we know, but very impactful, affecting your day-to-day relationships and success, whether that is at work or in a hobby or in a relationship that you have. So if you do, I just slid this whole thing. That was kind of fun. If you do look at many of these, you'll notice that some of the key terms, such as disrupting daily life, challenging and problem solving. So we can actually look at anything as a problem. As Sue mentioned, I enjoy a good cup of coffee. A problem for someone who may be starting to develop Alzheimer's disease may be fixing a pot of coffee. That can be a problem because there's multiple steps to make that happen, right? And there may be someone else in the room, hopefully besides myself, who didn't put a filter in one time when you made coffee and it didn't turn out really well. But if you did that once, because you also were listening to a television station, checking the date of your first appointment, and that multitasking opportunity, you could be concerned that, oh my goodness, I can't believe that I forgot to do this one item. But it is complicated and it is layered in our lives. New problems, number 6, I like to point out that it says new problems, because also, if you are not good with names, again, hopefully I have friends in the audience. I might have met a Michelle one day, and when I see Michelle again, I may call her Stephanie. Nowhere even close. Not even a Michelle and a Mary. Not even close to sharing the same. But that's not a new problem for me. I am not good with names. I'll remember your face. I'll be very friendly when I see you. But names is not something that I have a strong effort in. However, teachers, pastors, other individuals, that is a skill. If individuals who have a skill for names and start to see that slip, that might be a concern. Or financial matters. I don't know if there's many individuals using checkbooks anymore, but some people were never good at balancing checkbooks. If you're a CPA or a financial advisor and you're not getting some of these details right, that is a new problem. That is a problem being concerned about. Decreased or poor judgment. Okay, if we diagnosed everyone with Alzheimer's disease that we felt like had poor judgment, this would be, you know, most people here on earth. Again, we're all allowed to have some of these concerns, but we're talking about poor judgment maybe being an example of being taken advantage of financially, easily being scammed because of poor judgment and trust towards people that you don't know. Maybe that's also wearing very inappropriate clothing. What a blessing to have such a mild winter this year, but the years where we've had single digits and teen digits, if individuals with Alzheimer's disease were getting ready to go on a walk, they may make poor judgments and not fully put on the layers that they need. So impacting largely in their lives for health or financial concerns that can really be a safety issue. So these 10 items, the Alzheimer's Association has a two-sided worksheet. If you or someone you know is concerned, we have a bit of a worksheet that goes deeper than just these 10 bullet points and talks about what is normal aging and what is the warning signs. And then it gives you space to write down examples that you or someone you know might be experiencing and then be able to talk with family and friends about that and carry that to your physician. And so I recommend and encourage anyone to contact us or visit the website if you'd like to look at this into more details. We're going to transition and look at dementia. And we are going to look at a few different kinds of dementia, including Alzheimer's disease. So we're going to start at just the term of dementia. In my 12 years at the Alzheimer's Association, it's been a very frequent question. What is the difference between Alzheimer's disease and dementia? Or people who say, I have Alzheimer's and not dementia, or vice versa. Right. And how physicians and healthcare providers may also be using these terms. So dementia is actually an umbrella term. Dementia is a series of symptoms, and it encompasses many other diseases. Okay, but as you look at the causes and changes, and on this particular slide, memory is at the forefront, which is often one of those key pieces for Alzheimer's disease. But as you look at all of these changes, this is something that is dementia. If a healthcare provider or a physician is diagnosing an individual with dementia, they are talking about the symptoms you're experiencing, and they're not addressing why are you experiencing these symptoms. And that brings me to the next point, which is there can be some reversible forms and reversible reasons why people are experiencing the symptoms of dementia. Again, another question, another struggle that families have come to the Alzheimer's Association about is, I'm concerned about someone I know, and they do not want to go to the doctor. Maybe they're just not doctor people. Maybe they do not have insurance. Maybe they are fearful for what the doctor might say. Maybe there's not a good relationship or trust with the physician. But at a time like that, and when we don't know what is happening with an individual, to remind people that there are some reversible causes to dementia listed here. And so we aren't saying because you're experiencing memory concerns or changes in judgment or behaviors automatically that you have Alzheimer's disease. No. We're saying let's look at this. Let's look at the 10 signs. Let's have a conversation. Let's get the blood work done. Let's look at family history. And so if you know of someone who, for whatever reason, is not interested in visiting a physician, encourage also that you may not know what is going on, but that there might be a reversible reason why some of these symptoms are coming up. Another one that is not on here or it's shared as emotional disorder is major depressive disorder. And so grief, high levels of grief, major depression might also be a reason why people are experiencing some changes in thought process. This was the slide I was looking for. It was the very next one. So here is the idea of dementia being at the top, being a bit of an umbrella, like the word flowers. There's many kinds of flowers. Like the word vegetables, there's many kinds of vegetables, right? So dementia is all of these symptoms, and I encourage every family who's getting a diagnosis of dementia, if they're interested, please follow up with the question, what kind? Why? What can I expect next? Because as I said, there is no prevention, there is no treatment, and there is no cure, but there is power in education to how these diseases are a bit different from each other and how they also progress a bit different from each other. So Alzheimer's disease, we're actually going to talk about last. We're going to go a bit in reverse to the diseases that are not as common. And Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease is also known as mad cow disease. You've heard that maybe more in the past of mad cow disease and how that sometimes can impact individuals on a very fast and fatal way. But also Parkinson's. Dementia will often come towards the end of Parkinson's disease. Parkinson's first showing that rigid behavior or tremor behavior, and that as the progression of that form of neurological disease occurs, dementia will be added on, sometimes specifically Alzheimer's disease added onto Parkinson's. Huntington's is very highly genetic, so many families know if that is something that you are experiencing in your family ahead of time, that it is a very highly genetic disease. And it also has some similarities to Parkinson's, but again, has more of a physical neurological aspect to that. Normal pressure hydrocephalus. There is some treatment for normal pressure hydrocephalus. It is fluid and pressure in our brain, so it does affect many things, as our brain is an amazing organ. We're going to talk a minute about that as well. And then I like to just say WK syndrome, because I'm not sure if I've said that correctly in the 12 years I've been with the Alzheimer's Association. But that last syndrome is going to be related to individuals with alcoholism, primarily as being the greatest risk factor for that particular reason of dementia. Mild cognitive impairment we'll address as well before Alzheimer's disease, because mild cognitive impairment is a bit in the middle of, quote, common or age-related cognitive problems and Alzheimer's disease. Mild cognitive impairment is something impacting you on a day-to-day basis, and there is a high risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. But mild cognitive impairment is not a progressive dementia in itself. There is possibly 30% of individuals over the age of 70 that have mild cognitive impairment. So it is fairly common. And you do, again, each year that you have mild cognitive impairment, you will most likely be visiting your neurologist and be given tests to see if you have progressed further into Alzheimer's disease. So here's another example of someone who has been impacted. Steve has a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease.
The types of things I noticed had to do with organizational abilities, mental abilities, and I was getting confused. I was finding it hard to plan, and there were two pivotal sort of moments that really brought this home to me. And the first one happened when I went into work one morning and sat down at my desk to plan out my day, and couldn't figure out what to do, and literally sat there for an hour frozen and could not figure out what piece of paper to pick up first.
So Alzheimer's disease. Alzheimer's disease is the most common form of dementia. 70% of all forms of dementia are Alzheimer's disease. And the Alzheimer's Association, I like to point out anytime I'm doing a presentation, if you look on the lower right-hand corner here, in between the words Alzheimer's Association, there is a symbol, part of our logo. And if anyone here today has marketing background or has worked with logos at all, you can appreciate that there is a purpose behind any symbol or visual that is embedded in that. And that symbol is to stand for people and science. If you can't see it, you'll see it on any of our literature, but it is essentially a upwards circle, and it loops and does an underneath circle, all attached to each other. So the first is a person, a human's head, to talk about people. And the second is to look like an Urbemarle flask in chemistry to talk about research. And so Alzheimer's disease and the Alzheimer's Association, once in the 70s, we were and still are on paper the Alzheimer's Disease and Related Disorder Association. Over time, we've truncated to Alzheimer's Association, and that is because Alzheimer's is the most common form. You will actually be hearing and noticing over the next quarter that the Alzheimer's Association is opening up our title again and wanting to purposely let communities know that it is Alzheimer's and related dementias that the Alzheimer's Association is working with and supporting. But here, just to talk about Alzheimer's disease, similar with the other dementias as far as treatment, not being there, prevention, not known yet, and still no cure. There are over 5 million Americans with Alzheimer's disease, and it does encompass those those warning signs and those pieces of dementia, including memory, problem solving, judgment, and progresses into communication changes as well. Let me go back just one. I'd also like to just point out the two next forms most common that are dementias is vascular dementia and also frontotemporal dementia, which includes Pick's disease. So there are many different terms. And so, you know, I think we find sometimes that doctors will say it is dementia and either not fully disclose that it's Alzheimer's disease or maybe not know that it's Alzheimer's disease, but sometimes feeling like they don't want to put on individuals to need to know more information about frontotemporal PICs, the Jacobs disease, the different kinds and how they all are different, because that brings up more questions. And the reality is education and support and planning is all that you can do about any of these dementias. But vascular disease will come up for risks of stroke or after having strokes. And again, we'll talk about further risks for all of these dementias. And then frontotemporal disease, the front part of our brain, that is actually first going to be seen with judgment and personality changes before seeing memory issues. So as you can see, there's a lot. There's quite a spectrum of dementias that are out there. And our brain, as a licensed clinical social worker, I don't do a whole lot with brains over the years, but we can appreciate that our brains are an amazing factory of doing anything that our body wants to do. And Alzheimer's disease has two primary proteins that become essentially out of control or over excess in our brain. And one of those is often called amyloid plaque. You may have heard of the term of amyloid and amyloid plaque. And the other is tau protein, a tau tangle that scientists will use. And I like to point out plaques and tangles because those are words that we might be more visually impaired to think about, or not impaired, visually apt to think about. One is plaque. And if we have neurons and cells and many communication contacts in our brain, and there is plaque or an excess of a coating on top of this, just as we can think about plaque in our mouth, the connections are not going to happen as well. The information is not going to be spread throughout our brain as well. Same with the term tangles. Think about fishing wire or yarn or hair, whatever you might want to think of as a tangle. And if that is here in our brain, it is suffocating and killing cells in our brains by creating tangles that, again, information cannot be processed, but also can be killed by suffocation, so to speak, in the brain. This is a little bit of a visual to show the many areas that we have talked about for dementia impacting in the brain and how our entire brain is impacted by Alzheimer's disease and all of these dementias because the plaque and the tangles are continuing to destroy the cell throughout different areas. So everything from starting in our memory and language area, but also we heard from an individual impacted by the disease, balance. And how movement and balance is also impacted and held in our brain. Temperature, touch, pain. Individuals with Alzheimer's disease towards the end of their progression may not notice pain, may not know, or may be too hot or too cold, that these sensory items are quite different. I was at a conference in D.C. one year. We do an advocacy conference. And I was walking with a gentleman down a corridor who had Alzheimer's disease. And we both probably had our water bottles. But I succinctly remember he was carrying water with him. And as we walked, he dropped his water bottle. Not a big deal. We all might drop a water bottle. But he pointed out to me that day, he drops things all the time because his brain is having to think about standing up straight, walking straight ahead, speaking to the person next to him, all the things that all of our brains are going to think about and do. But because he has Alzheimer's disease, multitasking in the brain, his brain will forget that he is grasping a water bottle or anything else, and he might drop it out of his hand because the brain is in control of all of these things for us in our day-to-day lives. This is a quick picture just to show how if you were to slice a piece of our brain and look at it sideways, how a healthy brain looks different, looks bigger, but also that it has more space to it. The one on the right obviously looks a little bit more skeleton-ish, and this is the same part of the brain, but to notice that parts have actually been killed off in the brain, that the hippocampus is where our memory is, essentially in the middle of our brain stem, and also that whole spaces that would be common to all of our brains are going to expand. And so what the disease physically does to our brain, as well as the symptoms that we are experiencing in relationship with others. So we're going to look at risk factors. We've talked a lot about age. Age is our greatest risk factor. And also the other things that we can't impact is genetics, right? There is a bit of a familiar tie to the disease. Yes, if Alzheimer's runs in your family, it does increase your risk. But even if both of your parents were diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, that still does not give you 100% certainty of developing the disease. So there is a tie, there is a greater risk, but it is less than 1% of all individuals with Alzheimer's who have the dominant familiarity of the disease. Less than 1% of that 5 million individuals impacted. And those individuals are often in their 30s and 40s. And have 3 chromosome mutations. Down syndrome is correlated with Alzheimer's disease as well. And we have seen over the years, still not knowing why, but getting closer to knowing why women are developing Alzheimer's disease at a greater risk than men. For individuals between the ages of 65 and 85, so we talked about baby boomers, right, and how that's increasing and increasing so much of our population being affected. Between the ages of 65 and 85, 1 in 8 men develop Alzheimer's. Now, again, I talked about many forms of dementia, but right now I'm talking about Alzheimer's disease, the most common. 1 in 8 men between the ages of 65 and 85, and 1 in 6 women between the ages of 65 and 85. We are doing more research. The Alzheimer's Association, again, part of our mission is to look at research. Also, Maria Shriver has a specific goal and passion around women and the disease, is looking at what is it about women, estrogen, childbirth, what is it that women are developing the disease. There used to be a thought that it was because women lived longer. And so there was a thought women lived longer, therefore that age, a greatest risk is going to happen. But now it's not quite that simple, and we're not sure why. But that is a question the Alzheimer's Association is asking often, because we want to figure out where do we get to prevention or treatment. But women are impacted at a greater rate than men. Also, over age 85, it is almost a 50% chance in developing the disease. So yes, many people over the age of 85 develop Alzheimer's disease, but we're talking about 50%. So that also means 50% of individuals over the age of 85, it is not common. They will not develop Alzheimer's disease. And so there's many individuals that, you know, maybe jump to the conclusion that after a certain age, well, of course you're going to get Alzheimer's, you're 93 or whatever that may be. But if there is no of course. There is still 50% of individuals over the age of 85. It does become more common. It is still not normal. So if you are, again, curious about yourself or another person you might know, and you're wondering, okay, so I look at this warning signs worksheet, or I'm concerned, now what? A handful of years ago, Medicare now has a billable code for physicians to do a cognitive screening every year for any individual with Medicare. Okay, what the Alzheimer's Association is continuing to talk about and to focus further on with any physician is what does that screening look like? So it does look different because there is no mandated way to screen all individuals with Medicare, but there is an annual screening, which means any individual with Medicare can go to their physician and make sure that that is addressed or talked about during that visit. Okay. Any physician can diagnose Alzheimer's disease or related dementia. But yes, if you are under the age of 65, or maybe you have variety of concerns or health conditions, you may be, and you may want to be referred to a neurologist for further testing and more specific knowledge. But primary care physicians can diagnose, they can prescribe medications that are out there. And I'm going to talk about that. I know it's a slide coming, so it might be the very next one. In addition to the warning signs and knowing when you're concerned, giving examples of what you're experiencing or what family and friends are seeing with an individual, the Alzheimer's Association also has a draft sheet that you could look at and use for doctor appointments. And it's a bit of a doctor's checklist, because another piece that I have learned over the years is that as we're seeing our primary care physicians, it's an average of 7 minutes of time with our primary care physicians. And at one point at a conference down in Duke, they shared this 7 minute research with primary care physicians and said, ooh, but if you have a woman primary care physician, you get 9 minutes. So, you know, just so you know, in case you're shopping around for an extra 2 minutes, if that makes a difference to you. But we know, regardless if it's 7 or 9, or if we have a physician that spends a great deal of time with us, we know that when you are asked in the moment what your concerns are, that's when you don't remember them, right? Because you're on point, you're being asked, give me all these examples of everything that happened over the last 12 months, if it's just an annual exam that you're having. So the doctor's checklist that the Alzheimer's Association has walks you through just a handful of questions to kind of be thoughtful about what are you concerned about? How often are you seeing these concerns? How are they impacting your life? And so if you don't have Alzheimer's disease or that's not a concern, I still find some of those questions really helpful in a way to take a minute before going into any appointment and to think about that. It may also be that you are a family member joining someone, or a very good friend or guardian of an individual you know, and you're joining someone at a doctor's appointment. You also together can be thoughtful about what kind of questions do we want to capture and what kind of concerns do we have during this conversation today. So here's a little bit of the steps and the assessments that most physicians are going to go through in trying to determine, is this Alzheimer's disease? Because it is very hard to diagnose definitively Alzheimer's disease unless you are able to purchase a multi-$1,000 PET scan to show how much amyloid is in your brain, or if you're looking for a diagnosis post-mortem, which maybe isn't going to be much help if you're curious about your disease today. And so you go through kind of a series of opt-outs, right? A bit of trying to look at, yes, what your memory and reasoning is, what your genetic and history is in your family, but also looking at the full body, looking to see if you have any reversible reason to experience some dementia signs, and to look at the emotional causes as well, and to maybe bring in someone who's very close to you or sees you frequently to offer their concerns or their thoughts about what is being seen. You can also ask some of the big hospitals in this area or another hospital if there are neurologists, if they have the, if they are doing autopsies, neurological autopsies, and some hospitals do throughout the state of Virginia, and some also do in our community. But if they are doing autopsies, you can ask the question of how accurate are your diagnoses in comparison to your autopsies. So I don't want to fluctuate thoughts of our current, you know, two big hospitals here in this area. But that is a question you can ask, because sometimes there is the data that backs up. And I don't know the current data, but I do remember many years ago that one of the local hospitals here said that they had an over 93% accuracy from diagnosis to autopsy of Alzheimer's disease. So again, just if you're curious, and because without a treatment and without a cure, and maybe even when these things do occur, this isn't going to necessarily be a comfortable topic for families. And so I just welcome, and that is my job, to empower and advocate for families to ask questions and to dig a little bit deeper if you're curious with your medical team. So we're going to talk a few minutes about, let's say after we've gone through all this and there has been a neurological assessment, now there is a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease, and this just simply says, again, wow, now what? What do we do with this information? How is it delivered at a healthcare appointment? But also, you know, what is the grief process going to be for a chronic progressive disease that cannot be treated? And this is where hopefully the Alzheimer's Association and other support networks that you have built around family and friends can be supportive to you throughout the many emotions on both sides. And I do like to point out the word relief is up here. And the Alzheimer's Association has done studies in the last few years. Each March comes our facts and figures. So if you pick up materials on your way out, you'll see their 2019 facts and figures. And that is because next month, Alzheimer's Association will have our new facts and figures. But I believe it was maybe 3 years ago or so that there was a report as part of our facts and figures from individuals impacted by Alzheimer's that talked about the relief that patients felt when a diagnosis was given. Because in this space of, I'm really forgetting, I now can't use my phone, I'm frozen at my desk, I don't know how to spell simple words, oh my goodness, what is happening to me? And do other people see this, or do only I see this? Am I making it up? Just all of these things that could be thought about, that going through a supportive diagnosis and with people who can walk the path with you, that many individuals with a diagnosis shared, they were relieved to have a diagnosis because now they know what they're experiencing and can read more about it, connect with others who are impacted, and have a little bit more say in the planning for the future. So I do like to point out, because sometimes people will say relief. Who's going to be relieved to have a diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease? But that was part, clearly not everyone had said that, but that was also an overwhelming response from people who struggled with understanding what was going on. The stages of Alzheimer's disease, you may hear or have already heard that there are 7 stages of the disease. And so you can read about and you can look at Alzheimer's disease in 7 stages. The Alzheimer's Association often looks in 3, early, middle, and late. And there's not a right or wrong there, but what you might find in 7 stages and even in 3 stages is that depending on the aspect of the skill or the challenge the person's experiencing, they still may have one limb in an early stage and another limb in the middle, or one in stage 3 and a foot in stage 4. And so it still is not super linear. It tells you a little bit as to where the disease and the progression may be going. But I do like to point that out because you might hear, or again, already heard 7 stages, and that is true. We really just kind of look at early, middle, and late through the Alzheimer's Association. Early stage being oftentimes where people are still working, people are still driving. This is when memory concerns are starting to come up. But most frequently, individuals are not diagnosed until the middle stage. And that may be because there was a specific occasion, family gathering, car accident, might be that a spouse passed away or there was a moving transition that brought upon the family to say, ooh, we really got to talk about this. And those moments often happen more in the middle stages. But you miss out on the planning in the early stages, the connection with others in the early stages. The Alzheimer's Association across the country, we do have support for care partners, but we also really want to create social engagement programs for individuals that have a diagnosis. So people can feel like they're part of a community and having support and not feel isolated or not become isolated by choice because of the judgment that's out there. Monica's going to talk a minute about why planning early is very helpful and important in the disease.
Back to caregiving, and a lot of patients, families, and I count myself in this group, we're baby boomers. You know, we're used to things the way we want them, and everything's conveniently disposed of, arranged, whatever. But it's not so easy to try to take care of your aging parent who lives 5 states away. And one of the things that most of us have not dealt with is who's going to take care of mommy, who's going to take care of daddy, how am I going to manage her business affairs, who makes decisions for what she wants to do for her health care. I don't think that those are decisions and discussions that most families have early enough. We have them in crisis, but we don't do them early so that we know what the game plan is. And if there's anything that I think that all of us should do is have a discussion with our parents, both of them, one of them, whichever one is available, early enough on to say, how do you want things to go if this happens to you?
And life really takes on a journey of its own. We have a long to-do list each day, all of us do. And so to put another piece on our plate is not always exciting to think about. Yes, we have to keep everything up to date. And yes, we need to go ahead and plan financially, get that power of attorney put there, and get those wills up to date each time, and to continually review these. There's also, if you're not aware, there's an advanced directive collaborative here in Central Virginia as well. And so to point out that conversations about planning for our own future is very important to each of us. And that is also with Alzheimer's disease and other kinds of dementia, to be the power of what would you hope to happen. And we know that we can plan all we want and it may not occur as how we had hoped it to occur. But if we can be in control or a bit in the driving seat of being proactive to the changes, whether it is to move earlier close to family or to determine which family member someone with Alzheimer's disease is going to move towards, to have some of these conversations when everyone can be engaged, not around the Thanksgiving table, but to determine when can we talk about it and how often can we put some topics on the counter and the individual with Alzheimer's or related dementia can know that we as supporters are open to talking about it. And I think one of the very important keywords throughout any of these dementias is the term we, and that the diagnosis is impacting many people, including the person with the diagnosis, but how can we as a couple or as a family or as friends or in a faith community, how can we be supportive in walking the path of the disease? Be able to shop for resources together. It's always great to go window shopping when you don't need to purchase anything. So why not do that together? Be aware of the resources in the area, or if there might be a move, be aware of the resources in that area before you need them. This is something I talk to a lot of families about, and it's very hard to balance the proactive and reactive notion of moving, driving, finances, and I'm sure there's other reasons as well. And today we are hitting some of the highlights, but there are many more tips and details about each of these stages, as I mentioned, just early, middle, and late. But there's a caregiver center on our website, alz.org/care, brings you to more information about the stages, more information about communication changes, related behavioral changes. And so today, I always really feel like this slide in itself, and it is, we have common programs on this slide that last 16 hours on early, middle, and late stage. So there's a lot of education, there's a lot of meat, there's a lot of details. All of our common programs are online. I understand maybe not everyone learns well online, but I do like to point out that that entire 16-hour series is online, and it also is something that the Alzheimer's Association can work with families to walk through or give handouts or go to another organization and talk about the specific stages of the disease. To step into the planning early, right? The idea of we, and I think, wow, these five bullet points, I mean, five check marks, five items on your to-do list, right? But look how big they are. Look how much time and energy and coordination that this might take for a family. But to be aware that the sooner you know that there's not a reversible reason for dementia means that there's sooner conversations, mediations, educational opportunities, resources, and referrals available to tackle this in small groups, whether it's a support group or an education program, to learn the resources in the community that can help with the legal and financial piece as well, if that's not something that has been thought about or now with a chronic progressive disease needs to be thought about further. The Alzheimer's Association can help to direct you a bit towards individuals in any community. Knowing that we often have family throughout the country, we can direct you to some nonpartisan websites that can help you find resources to help with this. Okay, I do want to just point out, I say there's no treatment, but that doesn't mean there's not medication available. And so I just want to explain what I mean by those two terms that may not seem to fit together very well, especially since the word treat is up here. Medications that are available, I like to describe this as medications clearing cobwebs in the brain, but not being able to kill the spider. So the medications that are available are trying to help with word finding. They're sometimes presented as slowing a progression or giving longer quality of life because they are treating some of the symptoms. Unfortunately, not treating the underlying cause because we don't know how to change the increase of amyloid and tau. So I just like to point that out, that the spider's not being impacted, but that doesn't mean that these medications aren't helpful to individuals impacted by Alzheimer's and related disorders. It's another reason to sometimes know what kind of dementia you have, because some physicians will decide some medications are more helpful to specific kinds of dementia than others. And there also is a patch form as well for a medication. So if people have side effects to the pills, or if swallowing is a difficulty, there is a patch form as well. And right now, all of these medications are generic, and there continues to be research done and phase three trials to look at more medications to see how treating and actually changing the cognitive decline can be impacted over the years. We're almost done with the presentation, which is why it's almost full circle here, where we're going to hear from Dr. Peterson once again in regards to the medications.
Drugs. Primarily, we can expect that they may improve your learning and memory a little bit. They may improve your word-finding abilities. They may improve a person's social interaction. So there may be behavioral effects as well as the cognitive effects of these medications. But generally, they improve the overall situation to a certain extent. Now, is that in fact effective? We think so, but it's modest. In some people, they may not notice any particular difference. On the other hand, in some individuals, they may preserve their function for a longer period of time. However, these are not disease-modifying therapies, so they really don't have an impact on the overall outcome of the disease. Nevertheless, they may be very useful in the short run.
Thank you, Jim, for running. You could have had your skate or whatever those little scooters are to just go back and forth today. So there is clinical research studies going on. I brought some information about a program called Trial Match, which is a program you can call the Alzheimer's Association about or visit our website. Trial Match is one where you would put in your zip code and answer 12 questions, health-related, whether you are impacted by the disease with a diagnosis, as a caregiver, or you are otherwise considered a healthy volunteer. You can look into participating in clinical trials. There are approximately 50 trials going on right now between Maryland and North Carolina. Not all of these are pharmaceutical drugs. They might be stress. They might be questionnaires. But there is 50 opportunities. Not that any of us would qualify for all 50, but the Trial Match program just lets you know what is going on in your area and then empowers you, if you're interested, to call and make that next connection to become involved. But it does not sign you up for anything that you do not want to participate in. Just a little bit more information about the Alzheimer's Association and who we are. I mentioned some of our education and support opportunities. I brought to the table back here our caregiver support groups in this area, as well as our social engagement programs. and a monthly education program that is held at Sentara Martha Jefferson in the outpatient center that's open to anyone to attend. And so there's handouts about that information. If you're looking across the country, the Alzheimer's Association, our common programs are everywhere. So you can visit our website and put in a zip code to Utah or Atlanta, any place you'd like, to be able to share with family and friends how they can gain specific support or education in their area. And also throughout Central Virginia, you can look for the support groups. You can call our 24-hour helpline as well to just ask the question if you're not interested or wanting to use a computer to search and say, I'd really rather just talk to someone and have them tell me, or follow up with an email or a postal mail printout of resources in any specific area. We also have some opportunities to get engaged around advocacy and also around events. We have a golf tournament here in the Charlottesville area every May. The longest day, which is the summer solstice, happens in the summer, and the Alzheimer's Association looks at the longest day as the longest day if you are impacted by the disease as a care partner or as someone with a diagnosis, that it can be a very long day. There's a book titled The 36-Hour Day, and I've had a caregiver tell me before, too, it should really be a 48-hour book, because there can be long days if you are impacted personally by this disease. And then our Walk to End Alzheimer's is every fall. So there's many ways to become engaged with our mission around support and education or around events and advocacy to your liking. And as Sue mentioned, I also welcome anyone who's interested in presenting programs or being part of a support group or helping to volunteer in any way. We're going to close with Betsy.
To the Alzheimer's Association, they have information to help you plan and think through the critical steps that you need to take on immediately, and I think that's very important. I also think it's important to reach out and build the community of friends and family that will be there to help support you as you go through that. It's a critical disease that can't be done alone. And you can't care for a person alone in that process. There's too many stories about the difficulties that that brings. So I think early on it's important for you to build that community and those relationships so that you know you have people you can call on to help you when the time is there.
Thank you very much. There is an official way to do some question and answer so we can all hear the questions and be able to hear my answers.
Okay. Are there support groups for people who are developing Alzheimer's?
The support groups that are available for people who have a diagnosis of dementia are really through our social engagement programs. One of our social engagement programs is called a Memory Cafe. And that is open to individuals who have the disease to connect with others. And then we do sometimes have series of groups as well that kind of has a support and education base. But I would encourage you to look at the social engagement programs as that support for people with the diagnosis.
Increasingly, assisted living facilities are building or adding memory care units. Are you aware of any organizations, including your own, that can help a consumer make an informed judgment as about which of these programs are useful and well run?
Good question, because there are a lot of resources, and the Alzheimer's Association does provide some literature to kind of help with choosing. So you can visit alz.org/CRF. which stands for Community Resource Finder, or contact the Alzheimer's Association. We have how to choose PDF sheets for home care community-based care as well as long-term care. So essentially it helps to kind of what questions to ask, what to weigh, because it also is different for each family in looking at a new place to live, right? So it brings up some additional questions, but also what would be imperative, good to know for individuals looking at assisted living and those memory care units is that the Department of Social Services of the state of Virginia license all of our assisted livings, including the memory care units as well. And you can go to the Department of Social Services website and you can look at all the licensing reports. You can look at all violations. You can look at all founded complaints. So there's, I like to say there's a little bit of a balance between that quantitative information of licensing stats, what's the ratio, and then to look at the qualitative part of what questions do I ask, what should we be looking for when we're going. So we do have some handouts and also can kind of, I always encourage people to visit a support group if any of those dates work for you, because as an organization, we obviously are very objective in wanting to help people shop, but a support group gets to really tell you this place was great, this place wasn't, and maybe that information was last week's or maybe that information was last year, but again, it can just continue to fill up that decision pot with different information if you're hearing from other people who have experienced resources as well. And I'll also say that goes for home care agencies and elder lawyers and financial advisors, for really kind of any of those resources, support groups can be really helpful in addition. So thank you. Hope that answered.
As a member of a caregiver support group, I get to meet with Annie every 2 weeks, and I will say that it is one of the most wonderful experiences I've ever had with a group of people. I will also say that some of our members have done just what she said. They have gotten to the point where they have to put their loved one in a facility, and they've done a lot of research. And we also discuss this. And we also know that what one person's bad experience is not necessarily universal. So I think talking with other people who have this problem is the best way to find the best kind of care. And thank you so much for an excellent presentation, Annie.
Thank you.
So this may be a simplistic question, but I'm hearing about devices that someone can use, like a clock that has the day on it and the phones that have pictures and stuff like that. Can you talk to any that you feel are useful? And other than Amazon, is there some place to snag one of those for someone?
Right. Well, I think that's great. There is more and more kind of technological devices, but maybe whether it's disability devices or memory impairment specific devices. So an additional resource I would encourage is the ALZ store. The ALZ, ALZ store is an online company. They probably had magazines one time. Maybe they still have magazines. But it's not related to the Alzheimer's Association, and I find it more costly than Amazon. But it gives a lot of really good products to think about, you know, different ways to have medication dispensed in a safe way. Also, people brought to a support group one time a photo album that also had a place that you could push a button and record for 30 seconds. So someone who was going through the visual would also hear, "Mom, this is me and you on a cruise in 2000, or whatever it might be, as an audio that goes with it. But the ALZ store is another piece, whether you purchase from that or just gain some more ideas that might be able to offer some additional thoughts. I'd check that out.
Hi, my name is Kim Peel, and I'm with JABA, the Jefferson Area Board for Aging. And as you talked about building a community, a support system, I just wanted to remind everybody that I hope that you'll consider JABA to be part of your support system. We're at JABAcares.org, and what I think about as I listen to the presentation was there are so many different options between where you are and, you know, an assisted living or a nursing facility down the road. JABA has an adult care center just down the street on Hillsdale. We also have one in Louisa. So, and there's other options that, there are other things that our options counselors can help folks with as well. And many of those, most of them are free. And with our adult care centers, know that there's the fees, it can be very affordable. And if it means the difference between your loved one being able to come home at night to you each night, I really encourage folks to consider the adult care center. There's a 4-minute video on our website if you want to take a peek and see what it's like.
Thank you, Kim. Yeah, I will just piggyback on that because as a great resource, there's half day and full day timing at the Adult Day Center at JABA. There's scholarships and some sliding fee scales. And also, options counselors come to your home, come to an individual's home throughout the Jefferson area, Region 10 space. And that might be an occasion in other area agencies on aging as well. But I think that's very special when people can come directly to you if you're not driving or you live in a rural area, and that's a great service. PACE is also here in the area. It is different than JABA, but it also does offer some day resources in addition to sometimes some medical pieces if an individual has Medicaid and Medicare. So you can look at either of those options. Thank you.
I just wanted to mention that it's very hard sometimes to remember that when you're looking for services for a loved one, that you're not really looking for yourself, you're looking for them. And we're very blessed here in that practically every retirement community, including assisted living and memory care, has its own personality. So I just wanted to reinforce that when you are looking and doing your investigating, don't think of your needs as much from day to day as you are your loved one or your friend who is going to be living there, because it's going to be their home.
Great point. Thank you.
May I ask a question?
I've been very impressed by a book by Matthew Walker called Why We Sleep, and of all the connections that he makes between NREM sleep, which is our deep sleep phase, and Alzheimer's disease, to the extent that one can ask which is the chicken, which is the egg. And I wondered if the Alzheimer's Association has recommendations related to sleep studies. Apparently, each form of dementia has its own characteristic sleep pattern, and it's a relatively benign way of getting a diagnosis even, but also of understanding better what's going on. So do you work with sleep investigators as well?
Well, thank you. I wasn't aware of that book. I do not know about sleep studies or sleep investigation. It sounds like you actually know, and that book has educated you some on the specifics of sleep. I do know how sleep helps to formulate our memories in our brain, and also how sleep during the day with that REM sleep, sometimes individuals with dementia might take too long of a rest in the afternoon and feel like they're waking up in a new day than just in a restful time. So I can appreciate that there's a relationship there. However, I was not familiar. There you go. We got the book right here if anybody is interested of why we sleep. I also will just point out another risk of oxygen to the brain and sleep apnea, that if you or someone you know is not real excited to take care of their sleep apnea concern, that there is also a relationship, oxygen to the brain and being able to have that while you're sleeping and throughout the day, but also how sleep apnea can be an additional risk for dementia or to exacerbate any memory concerns that might be going on. So thank you for making that tie. And unfortunately, I can't offer more to what you're saying, but I do understand and appreciate there's a relationship. Thank you.